Neither is Pam. She's just choosing a better activity to manage what she's feeling. She's taught herself a great habit. The equation for change in any capacity is always very simple. For example, it's so simple to lose weight. It is so simple to get in shape. It's so simple to save money. It's all very, very simple. But it's not easy. It's not quick. It's not a reward that you're going to get immediately. You'll usually have to choose a harder thing where the reward comes later. The problem with most things in life is that the activity you want to do, the bad habit, offers a quicker reward than the thing that's better for you. It's difficult to make a change because the bad choices are much easier to access than the good ones. You've created a habit of bad habits. They feel more natural to you. Whatever you're listening to this book for, maybe you needed to get in shape, maybe you wanted to eat better, maybe you wanted to be more intentional with your partner, maybe you wanted to be a better mom, maybe you wanted to be calmer, maybe you wanted to battle your anxiety or your depression or to replace your depression with gratitude and joy. Maybe you wanted to reach for all those things, but maybe you have a year or a decade or a lifetime of habitually being angry, pushing people away, binge eating, abusing alcohol, ignoring your kids, being a workaholic. You have your own version. You fill in the blank. Maybe this makes you think you can't swap out the good actions for the bad ones, but I know for a fact that if you're breathing right now, if you're alive, that means you can start again. You can start again over and over and over until the feeling of moving in the right direction is more natural to you than the feeling of giving up. Whatever it is that you're facing, whatever your struggle is, whatever your hill is to climb, whatever you are trying to get through, there are ways to take ownership of that thing, and you can do it as you come back one day at a time and establish consistency. Establish a morning routine. The last thing I want us to talk about to set ourselves up for success is the ever-important morning routine. I know we discussed this earlier in the chapter, but it's such an important part of laying a solid foundation that I'd like us to spend a little more time on this and dig in deeper. It's hard to believe that having a good morning is such a key factor to setting yourself up for success, but it really is. I don't think I understood this until I had children. Before I had kids, the morning was my own. I decided when I wanted to wake up. I decided what I wanted to do with that time. I never once opened my eyes and saw a toddler staring at me like a creepy extra from Children of the Corn. But then I had kids, and suddenly someone else was dictating my mornings, which I suppose would be fine if I had been one of those well-organized mothers who managed to make parenting look effortless. But our reality was often messy and chaotic and hard and frustrating. We'd survive, barely, and I would get the kids off to school, but because the morning was chaotic and frustrating, I was starting almost every workday feeling chaotic and frustrated. It was hard to shake. It wasn't until I started the practice of waking up an hour before my children that I understood how powerful it is to get ahead of the day. Now, I am intentionally planning my morning routine around the kind of day I want to have, because if you own the morning, then you own the day. If you own the day, then you own the week. It's the ultimate routine you can set for yourself, and mine is made up of practices I've worked and reworked hundreds of times to get to the ultimate start to my days. I'm sharing it with you now to give you a head start on creating one for yourself. 1. I wake up at 5 a.m. Our kids typically wake up at 6:45, so I used to get up at 5:45 to give myself an hour of me time. But then I realized having only 1 hour of me time made me feel a little rushed. I really like the ritual of a slow cup of coffee in the morning, and I don't want to rush through it. So now, I wake up at 5 a.m. and go turn on the coffee pot. Someday, I'll learn how to program that stupid thing. I drink a glass of water while the coffee brews, and then I start working on my current project, whatever that may be. I like working on big projects early in the morning because I'm generally not awake enough to second-guess myself, which means I make a lot more progress. After I finish my morning work, I do a 15-minute meditation on gratitude. If you've never done meditation before, think of it as guided prayer. And in my case, I use the time to focus on my blessings, so I start my day aware of all the things that I have to be grateful for. Next, I write in my journal. This is a really quick habit of writing down my intentions for the day, a few things I'm grateful for, and an affirmation reminding me of who I want to be. Once I have gotten some things accomplished, had my coffee, and mentally prepared myself to be my best, it's time to wake up the hellions who live down the hall. The next hour of our day is all about the kids. This is when we do breakfast, brush teeth, get dressed for school, make lunches, and get everyone out the door. After the kids are at school, I hurry to get ready for work and always, always, always get ready to upbeat music. I absolutely love music, and I use it constantly to pump me up and get me going. I have an Amazon Echo in my bathroom, so I can voice command it to play anything at any point. I love that I can be in the shower and be like, "Alexa, play Shake It Off by Taylor Swift." And 2 seconds later, I'm jamming out to Tay Tay. Once I'm ready for work, I head back to the kitchen to make my green smoothie. It is not delicious or exciting, but it's full of a ton of stuff that's really good for me. It keeps me full for hours, and starting my day in a healthy way sets the tone for the hours that come after. The last thing I do as part of my morning routine is write down my list of 10 dreams and the one goal that's going to get me there fastest. 10, 10, 1. Remember? It's a great way to set my focus before I start on my to-do list, and I love that I have an entire notebook filled with things that remind me who it is I want to be. Behavior 6. Stop allowing them to talk you out of it. Have you ever experienced a situation where you were motivated and inspired and ready to push forward toward your goal? Maybe you were devoted to your weight loss journey and were making great strides. Maybe you decided to go back to school. Maybe you were training for that half marathon. Whatever it was, you were on it. And then someone else got in your way. This can manifest in a lot of ways for hundreds of reasons, but often it looks something like this. You are doing great on your diet, but then you go to a family gathering and someone in your family, or maybe several someones, gives you grief about it. But it's a special occasion. But it's Christmas. But we always have margaritas. What, you're just not going to drink now? And the thing is, staying on your diet during a family party or a holiday is really, really tough. So when they give you a hard time, at best, or tease you mercilessly, at worst, you allow the emotions they evoke in you to talk you into breaking your diet. Or maybe you're training for your first race, or you've decided to go back to school to get your master's degree. And at first, the people in your life are supportive. Going back to school is a good thing. Working out and getting in shape are great. Everyone around you agrees. But then you start to schedule time in your calendar to work on these things, and as the race ramps up, you've got to spend more and more hours training. Or maybe it's studying or writing a report for class. The free time you used to have is now devoted to your new goal. And the people in your life feel left out or left behind or, more typically, inconvenienced. These choices you're making for yourself feel more and more selfish, and someone in your life speaks into that. You know, it's really hard to handle the kids all by myself on Thursdays while you're at class. Or, we used to always hang out, and I feel like I never see you anymore. You were already feeling guilty about your choices, and it is getting harder by the day, so you bow to whatever would make everyone else happy. God forbid they might be upset with you. It's so much better to give up on your thing, your goal, because if anyone else is inconvenienced, then your goal must be wrong. Can we talk about that for a quick second? Can we talk about someone else being inconvenienced by you pursuing your best self? I want to bring it up because it's a question I get a lot. How can I get my mom to be more supportive? How do I convince my husband to watch the kids so I can work out? How can I get my boyfriend to eat healthy with me so it's easier for me to stay on track? How can I get my dad to support my decision to change majors? The best advice I know of in this situation is, if you want to change someone else, change yourself. People change because they're inspired by someone else's example, not because they were coerced into doing it. People change because they see in someone else what's probable, not because someone harasses them over and over about what's possible. You will never change someone else unless you find the courage and the will and the resolve to change yourself. And you will never do any of those things if you aren't willing to let people be inconvenienced by your journey. Being inconvenienced is part of any relationship. I will watch all four kids by myself for a couple of hours on Saturday so that Dave can go to the gym. He will watch all four kids by himself on Sunday so that I can go on a long run. Is it an inconvenience to solo parent that many beasties? Of course, but we both genuinely want the best for each other, and that means we're willing to do things that are hard on us so our partner can flourish. How many people work extra hours for years while their partner gets their degree? How many times have you done the grocery shopping? How many times has your partner taken out the trash or done the laundry or gotten up with the baby to make it easier on you? Being occasionally inconvenienced is a part of life, and if you're willing to do it for them, then you better be willing to demand that they do it for you. Sometimes all it takes is having a firm adult conversation. But sometimes the pushback is hard to stand strong against. It's inevitable that the people in your life will feel the discomfort that arises when you start restructuring your life to pursue new things. There are so many reasons why your friends or family members might not be supportive. Insecurity, fear, self-preservation, complacency, and so on. But this book isn't about their reasons, it's about you having a revelation. So listen up. Mediocre will always try and drag you back down to mediocre. Lazy will always try and drag you back down to lazy. For whatever reason, these people in your life aren't at the same place as you in their personal growth journey, and that's fine. We're all on our own paths, and it's not your job to try and pull them up with you. It's your job to show up for your own life and fight for your own dreams. To quote my friend Elizabeth, you need less wishbone and more backbone. That means you're going to have to make the decision that other people don't get to weigh in here. That means you will stand up for yourself and understand that someone who's sitting in the cheap seats doesn't get to tell you how to fight in the ring. If you're not out here on the field, if you're not fighting for more, if you're not running these miles with me or writing these words with me or making new habits with me or eating this kale with me, if you're not in the game with me, then you don't get to call any plays, and you darn sure don't get to offer negative comments about the work I'm putting in. Allowing someone else to talk you out of your pursuits is quite possibly one of the hardest habits to break, but one of the greatest behaviors to adopt. Part of what makes it hard is that we care about what other people think. It's ingrained in us from birth. But as we've talked about before, other people's opinions of you are none of your business. That's a bit harder to remember, though, when the opinions, even when they're wrong, are connected to the people we love and care about most. The thing is, you cannot control how they'll act or what they'll say or whether they'll be supportive. You can only control how you'll respond to what they do and whether you use their feelings as a reason to quit on yourself. Rather than alienate everyone or start a turf war with your sister or create problems in your relationships, here are some things you can do to ensure that you're better able to control your own reactions. 1. Ask yourself if this person should be in your life. Seriously. Think about it for a second. If someone doesn't want what's best for you, even if they don't understand it, it's either because y'all have a problem you need to work through, or they shouldn't be in your life. You either want to do life with people, meaning interact with them happily, or you shouldn't have them in your life, period. I know this seems almost blasphemous to some people, but you really, truly don't have to hang out with people who are negative or mean or make you anxious or bring out the worst in you. Even family. There are whole groups of blood relatives I haven't interacted with since I became an adult. As a child, I didn't have a choice, but as an adult, I decided I wouldn't ever allow people into my home and around my children who were mean or prone to creating drama or passive-aggressively bullying others. That's not the way we behave. And though it makes me sad because I miss the good times we had, I'm not willing to allow the bad times in order to be invited to the annual summer barbecue. Be kind or leave. That's our motto. And if you can't abide by it, then you're not the type of person I want in my life. 2. Prepare before you see them. More often than not, the answer isn't to cut someone out of your life. More often than not, you can recognize that they've got some insecurities and decide not to let it affect you. But if you wait until you're in front of your naysayer to decide how to respond to them, you're screwed. That's like being on a diet and waiting until you're starving to figure out what to eat. You've got a 0% chance of being the person you want to be if you're not intentional about it. Hope is not a strategy, remember? So the next time you're headed into a scenario where you'll likely interact with people who aren't supportive, ask yourself in advance how you can circumnavigate it. Please note that I didn't say avoid it. Heading to Thanksgiving with a plan to drink as much Pinot as possible to numb yourself to their comments is not an effective strategy. Believe me, I know from personal experience. Instead, ask yourself what is likely to come up. Steel yourself for the comments and have your responses ready to go. Know your why. Remind yourself what you're doing this for and why it matters so much to you. Prepare yourself physically. Listen to some great pump-up music to get in the right headspace and decide that this experience and interaction is going to be fantastic because you won't allow it to be anything else. If the interaction will be difficult because it has to do with diet or health or exercise, consider eating or working out or whatever you need to do before you interact. That way, it's already done. A few years ago, I became a pescatarian, and when I went to family parties, there often wasn't much I could eat. People noticed my mostly empty plate, which led to lots of comments and teasing about going LA on us. Many times I'd buckle and eat something I didn't want to eat, but leave the party frustrated and annoyed. I needed to prepare myself for a more successful interaction with people who might not understand my choices. Now, I just make a big salad and a great veggie side dish for every family party. This way, I've got something to eat that's on my diet, and my plate is full so no one questions what is or isn't there. Also, my salads are bomb, so everybody wins. 3. Plan intentionally to make it easier. I wish this section was as easy as telling you to have the people in your life, get with the program, and stop acting like unsupportive punks. But dude, it's not that easy. It wasn't that easy in my marriage or with my family, so I know it won't be that easy for your relationships either. Whenever I'm about to take on a new project or I've got a particularly busy season, I map it out in advance to make it as easy as possible on Dave. I plan for sitters. I figure out workarounds. I schedule like a maniac to make my hustle as little of an inconvenience as possible. Ultimately, though, working on your own goal typically means sacrificing in another area of your life. It means your partner is going to have to put the kids to bed on the nights you're at school. It means you can't join your girlfriends for Taco Tuesday anymore because you're committed to your health. It means time and energy focused in on the thing you're working for, which means less of those things other people may have come to expect. Talk to your partner and your friends and anyone whose opinion does matter to you. Tell them your why and your how, and work together to find alternatives for the must-haves that won't be able to happen exactly as they did before. If you've done everything you can do to make the transition easy and fair for your loved ones, you'll be better prepared to manage the guilt when it starts to creep up and rob you of motivation. Behavior 7. Learn to say no. I recognize this may make me a pariah in certain social circles, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway. I don't volunteer at my kids' school. Not because I don't have time. My calendar is packed, but I'm in control of it. I could make time. And not because there isn't opportunity to do it. Because I get the request to sign up for craft day or the field trip to Underwood Family Farms just like every other parent. No, I don't volunteer at my children's school because I hate it. Shoot, I know I'm going to get angry notes about this, but I've got to be honest. It's my nightmare. For years and years, I signed up to volunteer. I was room mom, I stuffed the Thursday folders, I planned the parties, and herded children through the pumpkin patch during the fall field trip. And I hated every single part of it, except for getting to hang out with my kid during a weekday. Moms are supposed to want to hang out at school, right? They're supposed to want to volunteer. They're supposed to love every single child on the planet, especially everyone in their kid's second grade class. But I don't. Some of those kids on the field trips, they're the worst. You know it's true. And stuffing Thursday folders is so boring, I want to lie down and die. Right on top of that half-circle table they make you sit at in a chair made for an 8-year-old. I dislike it all. Immensely. Now, just so we're clear, I'll do it if it needs to be done. I faithfully showed up to 2 years of preschool board meetings. I worked the snack bar at the winter festival and planned the annual fundraiser for our local elementary school. Why? Because there was nobody else to do it, and I will totally take one for the team if it needs to be done. But if there are 87 other parents who love volunteering, and they're wondering would Ford's mom like to sign up for Classroom Helper Day this quarter, nope, no thank you. Years ago, Jen Hatmaker reminded us of this quote, "If it's not a hell yes, it's a no." Meaning, if someone asks you to do something outside of your regularly scheduled programming and your immediate gut reaction isn't hell yes, then you should absolutely say no thank you. Volunteering at school isn't my jam, and unless there's some kind of shortage on helpers, I'm not going to commit to it. It gets me all kinds of side eyes and snarky comments from the other moms at school, and I promise you, promise, that someone, somewhere, maybe many someones, just heard that I don't like to volunteer and got pissed. They decided right here and now, based on that single statement, that I'm a bad mom. You are never, ever supposed to admit you don't like certain parts of parenting. It's an unspoken rule. Not volunteering at school? I can imagine the impassioned listeners shaking their fists at the sky. What kind of monster doesn't want to help America's youth? What kind of jerk can't commit an hour a week helping out in the classroom? You need to get your priorities straight, sister. Here's the thing, though. My priorities are super straight. Here they are. Myself, my personal growth, and my faith. My husband and our commitment to an exceptional marriage. My children and my commitment to be an exceptional mother. My work and larger mission to give women the tools to change their lives. I'm sure there's some confusion here because I've listed out being an exceptional mother and yet I'm admitting that I won't volunteer at my kids' school. Well, here is the power of being extremely clear on your priorities and how they manifest according to you. I personally don't believe that I need to volunteer at their school to be a good mom. You may absolutely believe you do in your own life, and that's awesome because it'll give you some guidance on how to lay out your own wills and won'ts. But for me, volunteering doesn't equal parental success. Cheering at sporting events, sitting for hours during the school musical, regularly having family dinners and family vacations, taking the kids on business trips so they get alone time with me, reading bedtime stories, tucking them in at night. These are just a handful of things that are sacrosanct to me as a mom. These are just a few of my hell yes moments when it comes to parenting. These are what I'm committed to do no matter what. But to make sure I have time to get to all the things on my priorities list, not just my children, I've got to be crystal clear about what matters to me and to them. Notice that nowhere on the list did I write out, make sure the other moms at school approve of me, or live life to meet other people's expectations and priorities. I don't have the time or the energy for that. I've decided on four areas of focus for my life, and if the activity I've been invited to take part in doesn't serve one of those four things, then I can't do it. Remember, if everything is important, then nothing is. If everything demands your attention, you'll never have focus. If you allow other people to dictate your schedule to you, they absolutely will. I've learned to say no. More than that, I've learned to say no without even 1 second of guilt or shame about it, and I can tell you that it's magic. I get to live life in a way that makes sense for my family, and I promise you we are all better off for it. My kids get more dedicated time in the areas that matter to us, and I'm not running through life exhausted and overextended. Have you learned to say no yet? Do you need to? Here is my best advice for how to teach yourself this practice. Respond ASAP. To stay organized in business, you're told to only touch something once. Meaning, if you open an email, you respond to it then. If you take a meeting, come up with a plan of action while you're in the room. Only touch it once. Well, this needs to apply to requests for your time as well. Only touch it once, in that as soon as you get the request, you respond as soon as possible in the affirmative or the negative. No maybes or probablys. Maybe and probably is code for, I don't really want to do this, but I don't want to tell you that. You likely won't suddenly develop the courage later to tell whoever is asking that you're not interested. Instead, you'll sit on it until it's too late to cancel and end up doing this thing you didn't actually want to do. That's how you become bitter Barbie. When someone asks you for something, go with your gut and respond as soon as possible. Be polite, but honest. I get so many requests, you guys. You can't even imagine the amount of emails asking for mentorship, advice, nonprofit support, and product endorsements flooding my inbox on the regular. For years and years, I agreed to every coffee date, every request to pick my brain, every charity opportunity that came my way, and I was drowning in it. I didn't know how to say no because I felt a responsibility to give back and show up for others. Then I had an epiphany. Every time I gave someone an hour, I was taking an hour away from my kids. Every time I gave someone an hour, that was less energy I had to devote to my marriage. Every yes to someone else was a no to me and my list of priorities. So I started being totally honest, and I did it in the most polite way possible. I told everyone who requested time that I couldn't commit to anything additionally this season because it would take time away from my family. Seriously, who is going to argue with you or be mad at you for that? Nobody. I never once had someone push back on this, but I have had many women write back and tell me that they'd never considered that perspective. A yes to their agenda is a no to yours. Be honest about what you can commit to and do it politely. Be firm. This almost plays into the idea of only touching something once, because if you don't do this effectively, you'll have someone reach out again and again, which is a waste of both your time and theirs. Be firm with others in a way that doesn't leave it open-ended, unless you'd truly like to revisit the opportunity later. Also, be firm with yourself. You've made the commitment to you and your goals, and it's important that you stick to your guns. Learn to say no, and say no effectively. Part 3. Skills to acquire. Skill. Noun. The ability to do something well. Expertise. Please note, in this section, we'll be talking about skills and not talents. These are not unique and special attributes you were born with. They are learned abilities. Developing a new skill set or growing in a certain area is something accomplished with focus and time and hard work. So, good news. Even if these aren't things you currently possess in your arsenal, you're still entirely capable of making them yours. No excuses, remember? We let go of those in part one. Skill one. Planning. The first time Dave and I went to Amsterdam, we got lost. We were a young married couple, and neither of us had ever traveled to Europe before. We made all the classic mistakes. We packed too many countries into too few days. We went to every tourist location the world has ever known. We lived in fear of the gypsies who might steal our worldly possessions. And so, though it pains me to admit it to you, we wore our passports and money under our clothes in special Velcro pouches created specifically for this purpose. Bless. On that trip, we went to London and later explored Rome and Florence and got trapped in Venice during an Italian transportation strike. But before that happened, there was Amsterdam. I will be fully transparent. We added Amsterdam to the list because the child nerds that we were thought it would be cool to go to a country where you could get a cup of coffee and legal marijuana in the same establishment. Did either of us smoke marijuana or even eat it inside brownies? No! Which is why it felt illicit enough to visit an entire country for just this purpose. In our defense, this was circa 2005. So marijuana wasn't easily available like it is today. Also, we were idiots. But back to Amsterdam. We flew from London to Amsterdam on Ryanair. Basically, an aerodynamic cardboard box with all the luxury amenities of a medieval oubliette. But on our way in to land, the plane reared us back up into the sky. The fog was too thick, apparently, and we had to be rerouted. If you're young, you'll have to imagine a time before smartphones existed. The rest of us still have nightmares about those days, but we were in the thick of it. We were rerouted to, wait for it, an entirely different country. I honestly don't know how this is possible, but it's true. Rather than landing in Amsterdam, we landed in Frankfurt, Germany. Y'all, I did not have a German translation book. I did not have Lonely Planet's Guide to Germany with all the helpful little English phrases because I never intended to go there. We were so stinking confused. Somehow, through many questions and even more pantomiming, we gathered that we'd now be getting on a bus. An honest-to-goodness bus that would then drive us into Amsterdam. The bus was crammed to the gills with Europeans in giant parkas to contend with the winter temps. It smelled like my minivan after a half-full bottle has been allowed to bake inside it undetected in the Texas heat. Sour and wrong. We were nauseated and not entirely positive that this was really where we were supposed to be. Next came the train. In retrospect, I'm not even sure how we made it this far. Maybe we just blindly followed the other people on the airplane/bus right onto that train. But one way or another, we were finally on our way to Amsterdam. When we arrived in the city, we walked out of the train station with no clue how to get to our hotel. We had a printout of the name and the address, and we just sort of awkwardly asked one person after another, "Do you know how to get to this hotel?" That person didn't speak English. We tried another. "Excuse me, do you know how to get to this hotel?" Another confused person who couldn't answer us. Person after person either didn't understand what we were asking or answered us in a language we couldn't decipher. We flagged down a taxi and showed him the address. "Amsterdam," he told us. "Yes, yes, sir, Amsterdam. Can you take us?" We were exhausted at this point, had been asking people while towing our suitcases behind us for nearly an hour. "Amsterdam," he said again. And when we just looked at him confused, he drove off. We started asking every person we passed until finally, blessedly, we found a man who spoke broken English. "Sir, do you know how to get to this hotel?" I pointed emphatically at the address on my now wrinkled and dirty paper. He looked at the paper, then back at us, then back at the paper again. "Yes, is Amsterdam." "Yes, we know," I pointed to the streets around me. "Which direction? How do we get there?" "Is Amsterdam," he said again. I wanted to scream or cry, and he must have sensed my growing distress because he stiltedly fought his way through his response. "Hotel is Amsterdam," he told us. "You are here." Horror started to dawn on me. "Where is here?" I asked him. He shook his head. "Not Amsterdam." "You guys, we weren't even in the right city. We were still 2 hours away from it. Likely we were supposed to get on another train to take us there, but we didn't know. We were sheep. We followed the crowd. What was supposed to be a 2-hour flight ended up being an entire day of planes and trains and automobiles. And we didn't get to the hotel until it was too late to do anything. I'm sure God was trying to keep me from ingesting illicit baked goods on foreign soil. But the point is still the same. The first step toward achieving your goal is to know where you're headed. The problem is that often people think that's all they need to know. They forget one crucial piece of the puzzle. A map only works if you know both your end and your starting point. Said another way, you cannot get to where you want to go if you don't know where you are. You need a roadmap. You need a starting point. You need a finish line. You need to know the guideposts and mile markers along the way. You need a plan of attack. You can talk about the things you want for your life every single day. I'm sure you can even find friends who will go to coffee with you and daydream and brainstorm, but none of that matters if you don't actually develop a real plan to get you where you want to be. People don't get lost because they're not sure where they want to go. People get lost because they start out on a path and don't keep checking to make sure they're still headed in the right direction. How often do you set out on a road trip without a map or directions? The only time we do that is if we don't care where we end up. We just want to take a drive and listen to music and see what we find. But if we actually have somewhere we want to be, if we actually have a destination in mind, we always have a map. Why? Because a map can get us there faster and more efficiently. Because when we see something from a 10,000-foot view, we're able to plan for and anticipate things that might pop up along the way. It's much harder to have any kind of real strategy when you're on the road. I have used this roadmap strategy for every major work project or personal goal I've taken on over the last 15 years. It's how I landed all my major clients in the event industry. It's how I booked press for myself without a publicist and used that exposure to propel my career. It's how I trained for a 10K, then a half marathon, and finally a full marathon. It's how I wrote my first book and got my first book deal. It's the strategy and intention behind everything in my life, from products to relationships. And I'm convinced there isn't anything it couldn't work for. It's not complicated. It only has three components. The trick is to approach these elements out of the usual order we expect them to be in. See, we're taught to start at one, then get to two, then end up at three. This is incredibly confusing if you don't know what step two is. And how are you supposed to know what the steps are if you've never taken them before? I've found that if I flip the order and start with the finish line, then contemplate where I'm starting from, I can more easily define the steps in the middle that will take me from one place to another. Here's how I do it. The finish line. First of all, you've got to start at the end. Counterintuitive, perhaps, but super effective in figuring out which direction your path should go. By now, we've done enough work together that you should already have one clear and defining objective, one goal you're focused on right now. That's where you start. To give you an idea of exactly how I've used this roadmap strategy, I'm going to share a personal goal of mine from the past. I wanted to have a cookbook. I was a food blogger at the time, and having a cookbook felt like the ultimate goal. That was my finish line. I figured out my very specific what by zeroing in on my very specific why. I wanted a product for my fans that would commemorate my family recipes and be a first product offering that was in line with my brand at the time. The starting point. Now that you know where you want to go, you need to practice some self-awareness and be really honest about where you're starting from. What assets, resources, and habits do you currently have that are going to help you with your journey? How can you expand on them and use them for exponential growth? What habits do you have that might derail you or push you off course? How can you be intentional in planning around those in advance so they don't sneak up on you? What good habits could you develop to replace those negative ones? My starting place for my cookbook was great. As a food blogger, I knew photographers and designers and a food stylist to help me make it all look incredible. What I didn't have was a literary agent or experience in the cookbook space. I was super honest with myself about what I did and didn't have access to, and then I got to work. The guideposts and mile markers. Now that you know where you're going and you know where you're starting, the next step is a brainstorm of every single thing you can think of that might help you get closer to the goal. And a great brainstorm always starts with great questions. For instance, how could I get a cookbook deal? At the time, I had no idea. So I headed over to Google. I swear to you, the answer for literally everything exists on the internet for free. And I asked that exact question. There were all kinds of answers, and I wrote each and every one in a big idea soup. That's what I call my written brainstorm sessions, because they always look like a big, messy bowl of possibility. Anytime I'm creating a soup, my goal is to find at least 20 ideas for how I'm going to get there. I put down anything I can think of, and since it's a brainstorm, I don't debate whether it's a good idea. I just write it down. So in this instance, I wrote, write a book proposal, get a literary agent, grow my social media following, establish myself as an expert in this field, research book proposal, hire graphic designer, hire photographer, do recipe testing, and so on. The problem with stopping at this soup, besides the fact that it's overwhelming, is that there are too many possible directions to head. We want to create a clear direction, and this brainstorm page, while awesome to get your wheels spinning, is likely to create a lot of stops and starts and unproductive attempts. So in order to move forward, we've got to get it organized. The question is, how do we do that? The answer is, surprisingly, with another question. Look at your brainstorm. And ask yourself, of all the ideas you've got there, what are the three major things that if you actually achieve them, they would, without question, get you to your goal? Getting from 20 ideas down to three might seem impossible, especially since so many of them would be helpful. But I'm convinced that if you force yourself to come up with only three, those three will be the guideposts you'll need to get you back on track if you get lost along the way. How do you choose your three? Go to your end goal and ask yourself, what is the step that comes just before this? Then choose two more guideposts working back from there. The thing about a guidepost is that it's something you cannot easily achieve without taking a bunch of other steps to get you there. People often hesitate to write these down because they seem nearly as impossible as the dream itself. Their brains immediately start to come up with all the reasons that it's going to be impossible to achieve. Maybe they're like, sure, I can write down the thing. But eventually reality creeps back in and my negative self-talk creeps back in and I don't know how I'm going to get there and gosh, I'd like to do this thing, but I don't. No. Don't focus on the lack. Don't worry about how you'll hit each guidepost. How will stop you dead in your tracks. Obsessing over how is what stops us from going anywhere. Right now, we're not focused on the how. We're focused on the what. As in, what steps do I need to take to make this goal a reality? For my publishing journey, my roadmap started to take form when I forced myself to come up with my three guideposts. The very last step before getting a deal for publishing a cookbook is submitting a proposal to publishing houses. Guidepost number three. Okay, so what's the step before that? Well, Google told me that in order to submit to a publishing house, I had to have a literary agent. No publisher will just blindly accept a manuscript off the street. So finding a literary agent became the second guidepost on my map. Then I asked myself what I would need to secure a literary agent. There are so many ways to land one. But they all had one central thing in common. I'd need to create a proposal of some kind to explain what I wanted to do. That became the first guidepost in my roadmap. I had a starting point and an ending point and three major guideposts on the way. Now I was able to figure out the how, or as I like to call them, the mile markers. I had forced myself to come up with three major guideposts, but the mile markers can be numerous because these are all the little things, all the hows you're going to need to figure out and do to get you to that next guidepost. To identify them, you start at the beginning of your roadmap for the first time since you began laying it out, and you do another idea brainstorm with this question. What do I need to do to get from my starting point to my first guidepost? I suggest putting on some pump-up music and writing as much as you can, as fast as you can, anything that pops into your head. Don't even think about it. Just write down every idea you can think of that in any way could help you get to your first guidepost. I call this a possibilities list. Let's say your goal is to start a wedding planning business. Yes, I'm writing what I know, which means that your third guidepost would be to land some clients. Well, then your second guidepost would be to make sure your potential clients know about your business. You'll need a portfolio, an Instagram account, or a website where potential brides can see your work. Of course, none of that matters if you don't have any work to show off. So your first guidepost has to be the creation of that content. Since I have made this exact possibilities list to get me to this exact guidepost, I can tell you that the questions I asked myself along the way looked like this. How do I get content? Photographers? Florists? Should I partner with someone to design and produce different looks? Could I volunteer my time with other wedding planners in exchange for photos in my portfolio? How have other people created portfolios? Are there books I could read on this topic? Are there influencers I can follow who are talking about this subject? Whenever I'm not sure how to get to the next step, even today, I create a possibilities list and fill up pages and pages with things like, oh yeah, Sarah's cousin works for that company that I've been dying to have as a client. There were many times when I didn't remember I had a connection until I sat down and made my list. This happens because we spend so much time sitting in what we don't have that we don't realize the access we actually do have. Warning. This is often the place where the dreamers start wandering off the side of the highway to gather wildflowers rather than making any real traction toward their destination. For example, if my first guidepost is clearly create a book proposal, there are all sorts of things I could brainstorm to get me there. Researching book proposals, creating a Pinterest board of ideas, finding out the structure of a book proposal for this genre, talking to authors in this space and asking them for advice, finding a graphic designer to help me lay it out, taking an online course to learn about book proposals, going to a writer's conference, and so forth. Most people see this list and get excited, thinking, "Holy crap, look at all these ideas!" Simultaneously, they convince themselves that all ideas are created equal, and all of them will be effective. Don't get it twisted. Not all of these ideas will get me anywhere closer to my goal, but many of these ideas are way sexier and way more fun than the tasks that actually will get me there. Creating a Pinterest board? That's so fun. I think I'll do that. Ooh, and a writer's conference. I've always wanted to go to one of those. And brainstorming with my new friends from my writing club? That's perfect. We convince ourselves that all of these are great ideas and that we're spending dedicated time working toward our guideposts when really we're just walking around in circles. If I'm being honest with myself, I know the exact step that comes right before creating a book proposal. I don't want to do it because it's the hardest, suckiest part of writing a book, but I know what it is. I've got to actually write the words. I want to encourage you here because if you're being realistic, then you must realize that a big part of the reason you haven't achieved the guidepost already is that your mile markers, while doable, take hard work. Mile markers are the achievable steps, and you can take one after another to get you to the destination, but they're always work. Always. As I sit reading this book, Girl Wash Your Face has been out in the world for almost a year, At this point, it's sold 2.6 million copies and become a number one New York Times bestseller. And I've received thousands and thousands of notes from women all over the world telling me how helpful it's been in their lives. What a gift. What an incredible blessing that's so big, I couldn't even have dreamed of it. Do you think that success made it any easier to write this book? No. Writing is always hard for me. It's always work. Even though I've done it so many times before, even though I've been able to experience success with it, even though I believe so deeply in what I'm writing about, even then, it's a slog to the finish line. The idea is not that a roadmap will magically make the journey easier. The idea is that a roadmap will make the journey effective. I believe deeply in what you're capable of. I think you can achieve anything you set your mind to, but you've got to set your mind to it. You've got to be relentless in your pursuit and flexible in your methods. So buck up and start creating the mile markers that will get you to each guidepost. If you're not sure what they are, then ask yourself better questions. For instance, if my question is, how can I sign with a literary agent? My answer at the time would have been, I have no idea, which gets me exactly nowhere. But if I change the question to, who might know how I can get a literary agent? Or where could I research to find out the answer? Or are there books or podcasts or YouTube videos about this? Then suddenly my answers are endless. Remember, if you're not getting effective answers, it's because you're not asking effective questions. Also, don't get freaked out about all the possibilities. This goal of yours is going to feel like something gigantic when you begin. Remember how to eat an elephant? One bite at a time. When you're first starting to work toward a goal, it's so easy to get overwhelmed. There are so many things to do and never enough hours to do them. If you're like me, you have 18 to-do lists going and they've got everything on them. If it feels overwhelming, it's because you're trying to do too many things at one time. Slow down. Make a daily list. Make a weekly list. Make a monthly list. Now double check them. Is everything on those lists essential to helping you get to the next guidepost? If not, revise and refocus. Now you've got your roadmap. The next step is almost as important as figuring out the rest of it. In between you and the goal that you've always wanted are three words. Maybe you write them down on a sticky note. Girl, maybe you should get it tattooed on your body, but it's this simple. Go all in. Go all in. Take massive action immediately. Not on Monday, not at the new year, not next month, but right now, today. Take massive action on the first mile marker on your roadmap. By the way, creating a roadmap in the first place is going to be a massive action for many of you. But please don't stop there. Stay in. For a lot of people, it's easy for them to go all in. They just don't stay there. Something will happen and life gets in the way and they fall off the wagon and think, ugh, now it's all downhill. No, no, sister. Half the battle in between you and where you want to go is just your willingness to stand back up. Everybody falls down. Everybody slips up. Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody gets off course. Plenty of people set out headed toward their goal. They've got their roadmap, they're following along, and then all of a sudden, something happens. Maybe it's something simple like slipping off their diet. Maybe they miss 1 week of training and then it's two and suddenly a whole month is gone. Maybe it's been 6 months or 6 years since they sat down at their computer to write. Whatever has happened, whatever you did or didn't do, shame isn't the answer to overcoming it. It's done. It's in the past, and beating yourself up about it won't change anything. Not only is that true, But so is the fact that it's not a life sentence. Anything other than death is temporary. The problem is that you're letting a short-term choice become your